I thought the fourth were meant to be all about headfirst dives and getting all crazy, said Gideon, who stared hard into every shadow. It's stupid to get killed if it doesn't help, said Isaac, tracing his thumbs in curious shapes along the door jamb. The fourth isn't cannon fodder. If we're first on the ground, we need to stay alive. Wards were the first thing I learned. When we get shipped out next year, we'll get them scarified onto our backs. Next year. Gideon was taut with impatience, but still spent a couple of seconds grappling with the notion that the gawky teens in front of her would be facing the Empire's foes at age 15 and whatever. For all that she'd longed to be on the front lines from the age of 8 up, it suddenly didn't seem like such a great idea. You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief. Episode 25. Sweet Dreams. So, obviously, this chapter is the most heartbreaking chapter in the book.
In the book. And I will cry in front of anyone who disagrees. In between my readings of this book, this is the chapter that haunts me. The scene at the end has, without a doubt, beyond any other scene, including any, you know, what happens to Gideon and how dramatically that happens. This is what breaks my heart. And reading this chapter again now with the deepened understanding of the reality of the fourth, with a deepened relationship with John Rhee. I always loved her, but, you know, I've been like really loving hard on her throughout this podcast because I do. And it's just like that much more gutting. And I remember when I looked at the production schedule and saw the note for this one. And like when we came to this door, there was an episode where I was like, I hate this door. And I didn't remember why. My body knew, though. It was like, we don't want to be here. This is a bad place. Because you have this softening of Gideon towards the teens, which I think very much the listener starts to soften towards them, having this all been through Gideon's lens. This whole chapter is designed to break our hearts in a way that I don't think any previous chapter has been written. You know, when I think of Tamsin Muir as a writer, like with writing as a set of skills, you have various structures, you have various scripts, you have various kind of things that you put together and then polish and then shape and sculpt. Like, what else has, like, I want to know, because I'm masochistic, what else Muir has written in this particular structure and style. Mm-hmm. I want to read the weird, heartbreaking Homestuck fanfic that this is structurally referencing. Like, writing-wise, this is such a different chapter from any of the other, like, it doesn't have that same kind of, well, the duality, we have two locations.
We do.
So there is that duality.
And it's a false contrast.
Say more.
Because it sets up, they're going into danger. They know that they're going into danger. They're prepared for danger. They're oriented to danger. And then the second location is safety. And we get all of these explicit flags for safety and for, like, yeah, she's still scared, but she is perceiving herself and moreover Jean-Marie is safe. Yeah. And then it's like, no, this one ends the same way.
It just feels awful. It just feels awful. You know, heartbreak, rest, safety, heartbreak. Like, it's just really delivered. But once you start also thinking about the multi-death theory, this is very much like, I think, a distinction between like first read and like person who has reread these books a lot is like, now on your multiple three read, you're now engaging with multi-death theory when reading this chapter.
Yeah, although I will say that my read of this has been destabilized by my recent costume reread. At the end, in the final showdown, Kithareya does say, I've spared you before, to Gideon, which seems to indicate this scene, that she chose not to kill her, not that she killed her and then she came back. And I don't know. It's possible that I was just wrong about that.
Okay. It doesn't contradict the plot either direction. And I think that's one of the interesting things about the mechanism of the multi-death theory is it doesn't change the narrative. Mm-hmm. Depending on which side of that of that understanding you subscribe to, it doesn't change the narrative. The narrative is written whether or not you read that from it. But it deeply changes our understanding of who and what Gideon is in a way that I think has more bearing on Nona than it does on Harrow the Ninth as a book. Mm-hmm. But like, it's this interesting detail where, oh fuck, what's the, I've brought this up before, this comparison where there's like a Shakespearean soliloquy that happens where there's a mystery, whether someone, there's a listener behind a curtain or not. Mm-hmm. And it changes the meaning. Well, no, there is a listener behind a curtain, but whether or not the speaker knows it is the thing that we're playing with here. You know, it changes our understanding of Gideon and our understanding of some of the, I think, gravity of the politics. If Gideon is like just actively reanimating, it makes this scene feel weirder because you have this bigger perspective of this like magical mechanism that's operating around these children's experience.
Mm.
And I think there's something strange about that. Like, you know, first read, you're like really zoomed in on, you know, Gideon's immediate emotional experience, the violence of what's happened to Jean-Marie and Isaac. Like, it's very immediate, very visceral, very in front of you. But as you kind of piece this out into the larger world, you know, learning what we do about the fourth, Gideon reflecting on, you know, her own ambitions and relationship to the perception of the military practices of the empire. Like, this scene is so strikingly different depending you're on your first read or multiple rereads in. Like, lots of chapters have different experiences, but this one is like dramatically different depending on which side of that you're on.
So Claire and I are on different time zones and we record in the morning usually, but my morning is much earlier than Claire's. And so what I did before this session was reread Wretched of the Earth.
Explain to me what Wretched of the Earth is. I'm presuming it's emotionally devastating fan work.
It's not. I'm so delighted to introduce you. So how familiar are you with the Algerian Revolution?
Probably not familiar enough.
Okay, great. So once upon a time, France took over large amounts of Africa.
Yeah, fuck France.
Yeah, totally. And also a number of colonies in the Americas.
Yep.
And one of these was...
I, in fact, am from one of those.
Oh, for sure. For sure, for sure, for sure. Of course. So you know about France.
I do know a bit about France.
So a Martinican scholar, Frantz Fanon, became a psychiatrist and was running a psychiatric hospital in colonized Algeria. Okay. And he did some really wonderful things in terms of making French colonial psychiatric hospitals less violent towards patients. But he came to the realization that what was really causing the psychiatric problems that his patients were facing was getting tortured by the French state. And he was like, really what they need is not a better hospital. It is to not be tortured by French police anymore. And so he left psychiatry and became a rebel and participated in the Algerian Revolution and wrote really, really important work on the theory of revolution and became a foundational decolonial scholar.
Sick.
Yeah. So he has a very, very influential book called The Wretched of the Earth, which is great.
And okay.
The first chapter of that book is called Concerning Violence. And it is about how colonization produces violence and how people think about violence in colonial situations and anti-colonial struggle.
And this has nothing to do with your case study of Canaan House that you definitely didn't assign yourself for homework recently?
I did recently do that. Not directly. I really did that. I read that for this episode.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
It's very obvious that Tamsin Muir wants you to have a sort of nuanced, complicated, maybe unsettled relationship to Kithareya in terms of why she's doing what she's doing and her loyalties and Blood of Eden. Like, I want to like and sympathize with Kithareya so much, but she's such an asshole because she's so appealing on her face in this like initial extended performance that we get of her. She's so charming. Mm-hmm. And at the end, when John insists to Harrow that like She was the best of us. She was the most compassionate, the most kind. And you're just like, what the fuck? Are you fucking kidding? Don't talk to me. But it's like, Tamsin Muir put that in there for a reason. It seems like she really wants us to struggle with how we feel about Kithaeraa. And I do. I do struggle with it a lot because on the one hand, like, I really want to sympathize with the anti-imperialist project. And on the other hand, she's such a dick and she killed my babies.
Yeah, she killed the babies.
I find that sort of the further that I am away from the text, the easier it is for me to be like, yeah, Kithaeraa is part of this bigger picture that I generally think is completely correct. Like, absolutely. Like, my Tumblr byline is flowers will grow on necromancy's grave. I'm like, absolutely, wreck it. Let's go. But I feel such a deep sympathy with Jean-Marie and Isaac, and this death is the hardest thing. And so I kind of continually come back to the question of like, how do I square that? Because I don't think I could possibly land on killing them was the right thing to do. Like, I don't think it's possible for me to get there. So like, so then what? So where do I end up? And so I spend a lot of time thinking about like, how did Kithaeraa get to a place where she felt like this was the right thing to do? And to what degree is that judgment shared within Blood of Eden? Like, how are they making sense of this? How are they coming to the place where they feel like this is the thing that they need to get free?
I don't think Kithaeraa anticipated killing children as part of this mission.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that she doesn't feel good about that.
Yeah, she got here and is just like everyone else, kind of fucking stuck.
Yeah. There isn't going to be another opportunity like this. And so it definitely seems like she's making the best of the situation that is at hand.
But that presumes that she has never had a situation where she has, like, in her, let's say, 9,000 years as a lictor in office. I'm actually, that's a long time to be being a henchman of an emperor. When I look at it that way, I'm like, nah, she's definitely done this before. She's killed children before.
She's definitely killed children before.
Yeah, for sure. She did it early. Like, here's the thing, is that as soon as you're an enforcer of the empire at, like, a moment of establishing hierarchy and an organization, that is a violent time.
And a thing that I was thinking about this morning is John brought her here to die. He planned on Isaac killing her, but he asked her here to die.
Yes, he did. You know, we have this larger understanding of the cost of life it took to develop the full Lictor theorem.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that those lives are exclusively adults, also hard for me to believe.
Yes. And we know that 500 went into just the skeleton servants and the priests. And I think there's no reason to assume that every life was used to its full potential.
Yeah. I would honestly almost commit to a reread for this in terms of level of interest, but just starting to do some accounting.
Mm. You and Palamides.
I love that guy so much. I really love him. I want to go to like a dinosaur museum with him. But I think doing some the accounting, like, if you look at, you know, so yes, there is a progression of normalization of violence as you get deeper and more extremely resource invested into maintaining the rules of an empire and the control of an empire. And the easiest way to document that is just it's ever expanding nature. It needs to constantly consume.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that has to start somewhere. And so, like, you know, in Harrow, we explore the roots of that more, but like here we have so many little flags of it. We have the, you know, size of families on the fourth, Gideon's clear relationship to the propaganda around this frontier war.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the difference between Jean-Marie and Isaac and their sense of preparedness to go out to the front. Like it's just these very personal notes of like, when you are at the actual edge of this enforcement, there are human experiences happening.
Yeah, and I think it was a really interesting choice to put so many of those elements together in this chapter, because this is a moment where, you know, in our excerpt, we see Gideon kind of rethinking like, oh, like when I was a child, I imagined myself being a child soldier. But now that I'm seeing children wanting to be child soldiers, that feels really wrong, actually. And we see Jean-Marie talk about being orphaned in war. This is also the first real mention that we get of the sort of imperial framing of who it is they're fighting. Mm-hmm. Her mother is killed by a grenade, and the grenade is just sort of treated almost as if it's a fact of nature. Like the grenade comes from nowhere. But her father is killed by insurgents. And insurgents is like, that was a big flag for me. I was like, oh, we are on purpose talking about like current world frameworks of terrorism as part of the commentary that we're making. Okay, cool. But this is like the first mention kind of that. And it clues in like, oh, people are resisting, because part of what Jean-Marie is describing is that these military targets died unexpectedly. They were not killed in frontline combat. They were killed in situations that the Empire thought were supposed to be safe. And things sort of aren't going correctly, which means that there's an asymmetrical warfare happening. And that makes sense for a colonial situation. They're not fighting another empire. They're fighting people who are trying not to get colonized. And that looks asymmetrical.
Yeah.
But we get those clues juxtaposed immediately to this heartbreaking pair of deaths. And that's such an interesting choice.
Yeah. It's out of like many chapters in many books that I have read, it's one of the most memorable. That fight is like in some ways so anime. There's all this emotional tension going into it. There is this franticness and it's really driven home by, you know, Jean-Marie's being like, he's not reckless. Like, why did he pick now to be stupid? Like this fight is like this snapping point. And I mean, maybe that's the parallel in structure as well, where there's this one experience kind of built in the beginning. It's emotional tension that leads to, you know, Isaac snapping and engaging in this combat. And the other one is like, you know, this like relaxing in safety until Gideon falls asleep and then wakes up.
I found that in the first reading of this, I almost kind of glossed over Isaac's combat and sort of my mental model for what happened is like Isaac fought, period. Then he was killed. And in this rereading, really thinking about this from the perspective, as you said, of like really foregrounding what does it mean to be child soldiers, he and Jean-Marie are talking about training that they have received that is frontline oriented. They have not enlisted yet, but they are being trained. And on this particular reread, I was reminded of research that in World War II, something like 15 to 25% of deployed soldiers ever fired their weapons in combat. Most people who are in a life and death situation do not fight. Modern military training post-World War II, because of these findings, is really, really oriented to prepare people to be able to take action under fire, to get those numbers up. And they're estimated to be a lot higher than they were during World War II. But the fact that he was able to face down this terrifying, huge monster and choose to fight tells me that he has been in situations that felt like real fights, whether they were or not, many times. And the fact that Jean-Marie has a settled opinion about what he's like in a real fight tells me that it felt very real to her as well, whether or not this was real fights or struggles for actual survival or not. They have been in situations that felt in their bodies like struggles for survival.
And it's normal enough, and it's been the case a repetitive amount of times enough that it's a mundane thing.
And that's not weird to Gideon either, because that's what her childhood also was like.
She didn't have to kill the babies. The option to just not kill all these people exists to her. She could just leave them here.
But how does she get John to get eaten by a resurrection beast?
And at the end of the day, I imagine this isn't even her, maybe Blood of Eden and hers first attempt to bait John into getting eaten by Resurrection Beast.
It seems like if there are multiple attempts on his life by his lictors all at once, then this is not a new thing. I would find it more believable that his lictors have been trying to kill him for a while than three of his longtime besties independently. Like, obviously they're not working totally independently, but we see so many attempts on his life. Clearly this isn't the first one.
No. And so then, you know, it continues to that question of the accounting of like, okay, is this the first time? Like, and now we're talking about time scale, because this is obviously a novel enough approach that none of the houses are like, we should be suspicious of internal fighting amongst the leadership and then possibly using us as pawns against each other and all of us dying in the process. We should not let them do that to us.
Yeah, there's clearly no
first time.
There's no cultural awareness of lictors trying to kill John.
So that does to me speak to an escalation in what you're willing to expend. Again, instrumentalizing the people in terms of the who is expendable is escalating.
Yes. I also think, you know, you can only do one really big betrayal before you don't get trusted anymore.
Yeah.
So it's possible that other attempts got quietly defused at earlier stages because they weren't going to go, or, you know, things happen. John doesn't know everything. So
it's the only thing everyone has over him.
It's the only thing.
He's not omnipotent. Like, fuck.
He can be wrong and he can just not know things. Obviously, Gideon was an attempt. So that was an earlier attempt. Deus Apate Major. I feel like they didn't try to kill him once and then wait almost 20 years and then suddenly just start trying to kill him again. They've been trying to kill him.
Yeah.
The reason that this points back to Fanon for me, and also to Ami Césaire, who is a close colleague of his, is part of their analysis is basically fascism is just colonialism pointed inward. We've talked so much about instrumentalization in this podcast, and this chapter really highlights the degree to which Jean-Marie and Isaac were instrumentalized from birth, that they were always going to be used as just a useful death. And it turns out it was a useful death against the empire instead of for the empire. And that's awful because they're wonderful. But also it would be awful. It should be awful. It should feel awful even if we don't know them.
Yeah.
It feels worse because we know them and we've seen them up close. But it's just as awful when it happens to the children of Blood of Eden.
It makes me think of how many art pieces about casualties of war are about like stopping to count and mm-hmm. to stop and recognize that there's an individual behind each of these single increments in these large stacks of numbers. And it's interesting when trying to create nuance in terms of empathy for the larger context of like children die in war. Children die on both sides in war. That is grossly oversimplifying what's going on here. But I think the focal point is saying that, like, even those on the side of organized power are not exempt. Like, as you say, fascism is colonialism turned inwards. Now it is consuming its own
mm-hmm.
to sustain itself. And seeing fascism as a, I hate to use this phrasing, but, like, logical progression for colonialism and empire, like, makes a fuck ton of sense. So when you have necromancy, you think of consumption in a very different way, mm-hmm. but there's still obviously a limited economy. Like they have to keep, you know, eating more planets to sustain this economy of necromancy. So it doesn't really mean that they're exempt from this need to eventually turn inward to sustain the effort. The resources required to maintain these efforts become higher than the actual, like, if you think of like the surface area of a sphere. Like, bodies on our planet only get so big, mm-hmm. and part of that has to do with surface area. The ability for a body to manage itself and its materials effectively for the course of an entire lifetime of an organism has a relationship to its size. And part of that is just the movement of things. And this way of looking at the limitations of organism sizes can be kind of projected onto colonial and empirical structures as well, because part of that ecosystem and that organism is based around the movement of materials and resources. Often see this thing is once an entity starts to cannibalize itself, we are now going down a very specific track.
I would be inclined to sort of hold in tension the sort of the colonial boomerang of like it starts in the colonies and then gets brought home mm-hmm. with the sort of opposite perspective from bell hooks that in order to enact violence against women, men first have to do violence to themselves. And I think that the sort of cycles of instrumentalization and violence and disposability are cyclical in that way, that you have to start within yourself in order to do it to somebody else. But then once you've done it to somebody else, you can bring it back in a worse form than it started.
Yeah. I you know, as we get into the thicker, hurtier, meatier parts of the both emotional and like political structures that form these books, like it makes me increasingly excited to read Nona. I'm going to need to read Nona just to recover from doing this podcast. Because it is wonderful that within this series so deftly shows us this world, that there's also stories of resistance and hope and family and like from the other side of the story that we need to see of like what shapes do these take? How do we see the other side of these stories? I love now looking back reading this book, how much space is given for John, Marie, and Isaac. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that we have been giving them a lot of emphasis, but as someone who are so much made into pawns in this entire ecosystem, like, you know, the few chapters that have really focused on their voices make me really, really appreciate how important that part is to seeing this world for the way that it is mm-hmm. and not romanticizing it as like, ooh, cool space swords and necromancy, like being like, actually, this is a world that normalizes an enormous amount of cruelty. Mm-hmm. And giving space to the voices that help us understand that, like, is a necessary part of not romanticizing.
One of the other sources that I go to in sort of making sense of the challenges of this chapter and this sort of episode is Simone de Beauvoir's Ethics of Ambiguity. How much do you know about her?
Not enough to really like play ball right away.
So I'm going to offer you one of the coolest and one of the uncoolest things about her that I know.
Great.
One of the coolest things about her is that she participated in the French Resistance and probably killed Nazis with her hands.
Good job.
One of the uncoolest things about her is that she and a bunch of her friends in the existential philosophy fandom had really fucked up ideas about what children's liberation meant vis-a-vis sex.
Oh, no.
And it's not clear whether she sexually abused children, but she did definitely facilitate sexual relationships between her partner and her and or his college age students, which right. I think is shitty. I want to say she says some really interesting things about fighting Nazis and some really shitty things about teenagers.
Okay.
When she talks about fighting Nazis, the thing that she says is that it's really, really important that you remember that they are as human as you are and have the full moral status of a human being and then decide to kill them. And that you cannot fall into the trap of dehumanizing them or treating them as non-people, as non-agents, as not counting. You can't be okay with it. It's actually important that you're not okay with it because it's fucked up that you have to do that and you have to do that. And I find that a very compelling position. It's easy for me, having not encountered John Marie's parents, to go, yeah, they were part of the imperial structure. I'm glad they did get blown up by insurgents. Go insurgents. And for Jean Marie, that's her mom.
Yeah.
That's her mom.
And narratively, it actually doesn't change the plausibility of all this, of whether or not John Marie's mom was a lovely woman or a total piece of crap. Abigail was a lovely woman. Like, I think for the purposes of what de Beauvoir was talking about, for the purposes of us really, truly appreciating what Muir is putting in front of us, is to be like, man, I bet John Marie's mom was awesome. I bet she was great. I bet her kids loved her and they had great times together as a family.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, they were well-loved within their community and had good reason to be well-loved. You know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, the fact that this is the reality of Isaac and Jean-Marie and the relationship that Magnus and Abigail had to them makes it Magnus and Abigail seem in more question to me. Like, they have this relationship with them knowing these children are going to die within a few years. I love them. And then when I look at them too closely, I feel very upset in my stomach. Because, like, I can see how them being like, hey, don't come down to the facility. Like, they're trying to protect these children in some ways. They're trying to give them, a gentle, loving, supportive existence for where they can. But in no way are in any way standing against the inevitable death that they are absolutely participating in preparing these children for.
Mm-hmm. And I think that points to the extreme difficulty and to some degree impossibility of just sort of opting out of the imperial framework you find yourself in.
Yeah.
If Abigail and Magnus had, in light of their affection for these two children, come to a political analysis of rejecting child soldiers and the structure of the empire, what is their next step? What's the move that's available to them?
I like imagining the timeline where that dinner turns into the beginnings of a revolution. Goodness knows, though, when the seats of power right one level below the emperor are the ones orchestrating the uprising. It doesn't exactly change too much about the fundamental hierarchies happening.
Well, and in fact, that's what we see in this Kithareia-led revolution is it's just more killing.
Yeah.
Whereas if Kithareia had not just spent 9,000 years being the, you know, basically second most powerful person that exists, like, what if Kithareia had at that dinner party taken a moment to be like, hey, so I actually know what Lictorhood is and how to do it. And they do, like, I want you to spend 5 seconds staring deeply into your cavalier's eyes for a second, and then I'm going to tell you something really hard. She could have tried to recruit those people, because what's the worst thing that could have happened if they had all said no? They can't kill her. Like, why not at least try?
Yeah.
And it's possible that it's because they're more useful as bait to try to get John to come. Because what's she going to do with them if they're just some guys? She has some guys.
Yeah, it really does emphasize how heartbreaking the feeling of being embedded and you know, tethered into various points within these systems are. And how it can make you see that you only have paths of fighting it that are essentially recreating it. Like, it's just more.
There's a moment in The Matrix where somebody is, I think, explaining to Neo that all of the people that you encounter in The Matrix were trying to get them free, and any of them could be an enemy. Neo has to sort of cope with all of these people are people who are worth saving, who might try to kill you at any moment.
It's really interesting looking at that now and realizing what a, like, iconic piece of transmedia that is, and how, like, that story of resistance within an environment that you have to remain incognito yet receptive. And similar to, I think, some of the way that Alok Menon talks about, like, relating to people and loving people in the world, seeing that that's, like, kind of a progression of, like, what modern day active dialogue about, you know, how the trans lens empowers us to engage with the world in a way that sees its liberation as valuable. But it, in both cases, it comes with this conflict, comes with this heartbreak, comes with this inescapable vulnerability. Like, as long as you're embedded within this organism, you're not actually safe.
Even kind of, like, worse, it would have been better if Abigail could have been saved. And it's easy to imagine a way that could have been what happened. And it's not what happened. And I think the weight of that is appealing to me as a philosophical problem. I think any time that somebody kills somebody else, things have gone wrong. And I am inclined to say that in, like, a well-functioning society, any time a person kills another person, no matter who they are in society, that's treated as, like, an emergency and a breakdown. So like the fact that people are getting killed raises for me alarms, like that things are not going as well as they could be.
Yeah.
But there's also the sort of real question of like, what was the alternative? Like if you had spent 9,000 years suffering against an immortal king god, and the only way you knew how to hurt him was to feed him to a resurrection beast, how would you do it?
You know, it's one of those things that you can assume that he's thought about this. So now you have to go above and beyond. Involve.
Yeah, also he's a super wizard. Oops.
Yeah, also he's a super wizard. Oops. Who doesn't even need to breathe air, apparently. He has thought about this and the ways that he's protecting himself from other people wishing ill on him enough that she has to be willing to take it further.
Oh, I think he does need to breathe air. I think he just lets himself die sometimes.
Oh, that makes more sense.
I could be wrong, we know that he doesn't have to care when he gets killed. So why not just be like, yeah, cool.
Just casually dying for the bit.
Regular Tuesday. Side note, his name is John. He might as well be blue. That's the first thing I learned.
What?
Oh my God, sorry. There's a physicist named John who becomes a demigod in The Watchmen.
Oh,
and somebody kills him, and then he puts himself back together from atoms and is like, bro, that's literally the first thing I learned. Of course that's fine. You can't just explode me. And I just feel like there's a parallel there.
Is this the guy who makes like a castle on the moon?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got
it. He moves to Mars because his girlfriend is mad at him.
I see what you're doing there. This chapter, you know, I look at the way that we've looked at it, and like we just not even one moment spent to following it linearly. That was never a priority in this chapter's analysis. I am curious to look at the kinds of details left in this chapter that we are not focusing on the way that we'd often focus on hints and details and stuff like that. Fuck, you know what I want to discuss? How that happened? How did the lights turn out? Are they on timers? Like, why is it very specifically this is a fucking horror movie scene type of lights turning off? Who was towing the light switches? How is that done?
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's just assume it's Kithrae's bone construct.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants it to have a dramatic entrance. She's using the theorem where it just puffs out of bone smog, right? Like it doesn't need time. It can just you can just put the fog in the room and the bone emerges out of it. Great. We've already seen how this is done.
Yeah, and Harrow does similar, where she will make a whole guy out of just like something that she can shoot under a door or whatever.
Yeah, you need a split second for it to appear, and then it's there. But there's light switches involved, and they're very dramatically involved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is like theater level lighting drama in this scene when just before the bone construct appears. Like, whoever is fucking with the lights knows about these lights in enough detail that they can make it seem like the level of familiarity required with the lighting setup so that you could do that and time it right while you're fucking watching these kids walk down the hallway. Like, either you were recently practicing or you're extremely familiar with this facility.
Which she is.
She is. But where are the light switches?
I don't think we've heard any mention of light switches, have we?
No, most of them have been automatic.
They've been motion activated. So it's possible that she has done something, created some sort of like necromantic film that has tampered with the sensors, and she really has the timing down.
Fucking commitment to the bit for this scene. Like just the, yeah. It's
also possible that she wasn't watching it live, but that this was, in fact, triggered by a ward that she set up.
A ward would make a lot of sense. A ward would make a lot of sense, and that also, to me, means that there's more of them around that we didn't end up finding.
That makes sense. Possibly, also, there have been other situations where people have triggered her wards but then escaped but are just not the kind of person to share their notes. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't know that the Eighth didn't run into a bone construct. We don't know that, like, Ianthe, because, well, I guess the Eighth would have stayed and fought it and just died. Ianthe would have bailed. So, like, if Ianthe had run into a bone construct, she would have left and she wouldn't have told anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although the message is specific.
So what was the first one? Was something to the fourth?
First one was death to the fourth house.
Death to the fourth house. And then the second one was sweet dreams. Mm-hmm. So the first one was very likely possibly ward pre-programmed.
That seems possible. The second one seems less possible because how would she have known that they would escape and then go to that room in particular? It seems like she has to be responding live.
Yes. Death in the fourth house feels personal. There's just something in the language of these. Death to the fourth house feels personal.
I thought it felt super impersonal that she was experiencing them as their house, as what the fourth house is and does, and was not interacting with them individually at all. But then Sweet Dreams felt so smug.
I think it personal in the sense of Kithareya has a personal spite against the fourth house, which would be about the other fourth house, Lictor, I imagine, rather than about Isaac and Jean-Marie.
I can't imagine that the fourth house beef was with Ulysses and Titania, because that's who the fourth house Lictor was.
So questions remain.
I would suspect that the aggression towards the fourth house specifically is because of the role that they play in the expansionist project. They are establishing new territories, and Blood of Eden is trying to hold them back. So Blood of Eden would be most engaged with the cohort and the fourth house.
Right. So death of the fourth house might even just be a commonly repeated phrase for morale and rallying.
Maybe. I think this is the first time that we see Kithareya sort of doing communication around the deaths, because there wasn't a clue like this with Magnus and Abigail.
Yeah. It feels a little anomalous. We already had this perception that Kithareya felt a little bit of hesitation or sympathy towards these youngsters. So, like, why ramp up the terror?
Yeah, the thing that made sense of that for me was assuming that this was actually about communication with John rather than about communication with them. That the person she's imagining as receiving this message ultimately is John rather than the immediate people who are going to be finding it.
That makes sense. Right, because these are pawns to get to John. This is a setup for John. Right. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That explains the language entirely. That is just like the shittiest, bitchiest notes you could fucking caption these scenes with.
Yeah. She's trying to taunt him. She wants him to come. And she wants him to come personally. So she wants him to be upset and make stupid choices.
So it means that either it was set up very recently, just as they came down, if it was a ward, or it's happening live. Because Kithareya would have had no way to know that it was Gideon and the fourth coming through next.
She did know.
I'm totally wrong about that. She was right there.
She was right there.
And Protesilaus is probably... Protesilaus is doing it.
No, Protesilaus was burned.
Oh, yeah. Protesilaus is burned along with the original Dulcie.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But I forgot about that until now. Like, Protesilaus was actually legitimately in there.
No, yeah. He was in there. But they died a couple weeks ago. So people were like, well, this couldn't be him because we just saw him.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed as I was doing my Canaan House field analysis was in this conversation about, like, oh, we should be the ones to go down to the facility. No, you should be the ones to go down. Nobody is involving, quote unquote, Dulcinea as an actual participant or like part of the group. They are treating her like she has no agency or anything to contribute mentally. So they have this whole tactical conversation in front of her without including her. So it's really easy to forget that she's in the room because they're treating her like she's not in the room.
Yeah.
So she knew where they were going and what they were doing and who was going because they told her.
Do you think teacher would have stopped her from leaving after them?
Well, she couldn't because she had Harrow and the sixth.
Oh, the sixth. Yeah, that's
right. So she wasn't physically down there. I don't know 100% kind of how she does this.
Yeah. She think so. Her plan is she kills everybody, and then John has to come down to deal with it. Is that explicit? Is that canon?
I believe so.
So that must mean that she has had to spend more time trying to psych herself up to killing kids. Because, like, why didn't she just kill everybody right away?
Yeah, why was it a big secret?
The simplest explanation is the fact that she's like, I didn't expect everyone to be so young.
But also her plan from the beginning involved impersonating Dulcinea. So yeah. Maybe she needed something on the first that was going to take her some time to access. Because I can only imagine that if I was Blood of Eden and I was sending her to the first, that is a once in a forever opportunity.
Trying to destroy the Lictorial theorems and evidence.
Trying to destroy it, trying to collect something, trying to study the ghosts. There's a sort of theory that the battery, the unknown power source, is this just well of souls that is all of the victims of John's nuclear attacks that sort of lives at the heart of Kanan House. I find that pretty compelling. I think it's not sort of textually strongly evidenced, but I think it's very possible. And it's possible that she was doing something, trying to figure out if that could be weaponized or something.
Yeah, rather than just blow this opportunity to be at Kanan House with an agent on site. Yeah.
Like, she's mega powerful. She could have swept all of them on day one if she'd wanted to.
Yeah, so there clearly was something else going on.
And it only gets harder to fight them as they learn about the Lictorial process, so... Yeah.
There must be another reason why she's delaying. I have many friends who are Taoists, and one of the things that I see them being very front and center about in responding to various events of violence is this, like, if one person has killed another, something has gone horribly wrong along the way. And there is really no... There's nearly no situation where genuinely, you know, full-heartedly celebrating someone else's death is free of grief and complication. Even if you've saved a world of lives, there's still a grief and a loss there, and it shouldn't have happened that way. And I appreciate that that's their position. I also have kind of decided that, like, some people need to be more okay with... And this is, like, a very personal reveal, where it's, like, some people actually need to be more comfortable with blood on their hands. Like, some people need to be willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And need to know that their souls will forever be harmed by that. And just, like, open eyes being like, yep, this is going to fucking hurt. It's going to feel like shit for the rest of my existence. And at some point it may be necessary and someone has to be able to say, okay, I'm willing to be the person to do it.
I don't want to say this in a mean way, but that's a very Joss Whedon take.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That's a theme that he really explores, of the idea of somebody who becomes the monster, not because they think that what they're doing is good, but because they think that a monster is necessary.
I'm willing to see it described in your way, but I don't think it is as the monster is necessary. It's more of a perspective of, like, we're not getting out of this, everyone being okay. And some people being decisive about, you know, certain costs psychically. Being like, I accept that this will be a cost that I take on. And I guess... You could extrapolate that into monsters are necessary. And I could see that absolutely having, you know, similar cornerstones. But it's interesting that, like, I have framed that differently in my mind.
Yeah. And I think that the question is, like, once you accept that sometimes bad things are good, meaning sometimes you should do a bad thing, mm-hmm. where are then the boundaries? How far can that take you?
Totally.
Because I don't disagree with you.
Yeah. It is interesting looking at ways that communities have navigated the question of justice and safety and predictability and transparency at various scales. Because we operate within systems that have very codified ways of responding to that at a large scale. But that often means that at a small scale, at the immediate scale, things actually don't happen with those systems. They're not effective at dealing with things. So then we have now the experience of being like, oh, okay, we start thinking about, you know, what would be described as vigilantism as ways of responding. There was a story about a town that there was this like real mean fella and everyone was scared of him. And one day he got shot in the middle of town. And when it went to be investigated, no one would talk. And this is a real thing that happens. because systems break down enough that communities are like, well, something has to happen. And we all understand that something has to happen.
That is also what lynching is.
That is also what lynching is. Absolutely. Yeah, because when you are at the end of the day at the mercy of the dominant body of priorities of mind, of like experience, whoever is currently running that group is going to set the tone over what's acceptable in terms of expressing that tension of violence under, you know, increasing environmental is almost always the context strain. Like in the case of this mean fucking guy that got shot and the whole village was quiet. Like one of the reasons he was mean was the circumstances of the Great Depression, like had led to, you know, generations of his family now experiencing hardship that leads to this kind of violence being part of what you think is necessary to survive.
There was a case, I think in South Africa this last year, where a woman basically like walked in on her child being raped and killed her child's rapist. And the government was like, yeah, okay. Understood. And I was really glad that she did not get punished for that.
Yeah.
It seemed like that was like an immediate reasonable action in the situation. And I was really glad that she was sort of allowed to do that. And also. I mean, I think what it comes down to is like, ultimately, this is the sort of inherent weakness of formal rules, that you can never have a formal rule that's perfect. Yeah. And ultimately it matters whether you're right.
Yeah. And you can't even say that the amount to which you are right in terms of like application of that rule directly indicates how right that rule was, because it's so circumstantial. It's so historical.
I think what this ultimately points to for me is questions about, like, on a theological level and on a moral level, I have a general commitment to the idea that nobody should ever kill anybody. And there's a sense that sort of sometimes killing seems to be the only way to solve a really big problem. And that descriptively, people will resort to killing if they feel like they need to. Part of what is raised by the killing of Jean-Marie and Isaac is, who is it okay to kill for your project? What's really, really heartbreaking about this is that they were so doomed from the start that neither of them were ever going to live more than a couple of years past this anyway. That if they became a lictor, then Isaac would live and Jean-Marie would die forever. If they didn't become a lictor, they would get blown up. And instead, they died here. Everybody was always going to use them and use their deaths for a political purpose. And the question was just who was going to do it? Whose pawn could they be?
Which isn't even a fate that, you know, the second is resigned to.
And they didn't even get to be the pawn for the person that they wanted to be a pawn for, and not that they were mature and formed enough to make a good decision about that.
Yeah. Now the internal conflict may be visible. Because, like, if it's known, like, the, you know, the missive to the houses, probably, you know, it's publicized. So now we know that the emperor is losing power and the faith of his lictors.
They don't know that
the call to the houses was like, the emperor's lictors have begged him for reinforcements.
Yes.
Which like, the fact that they are having to beg for reinforcements implies a certain position, and the fact that like, this isn't their first ask for support, like their faith in his ability to support them and what he expects of them has waned.
Oh, I actually read that really, really differently. This was part of the field analysis that I just did. Incidentally, we've mentioned this several times. My Tumblr is at Clocked Tomb. It's also my TikTok. And I just posted a number of long pieces of analysis. And one of them is this field analysis. I actually took that to be doing something really, really specific in both affirming the general hierarchy of power in the empire being God, lictors, everyone else, and demonstrating that the thing that the lictors get in addition to incredible cosmic power is a level of intimacy and personal love from God that is so unique and transcendent that he is willing to debase himself publicly for their benefit. Because he is like, hello, I am the God Emperor, and I am begging you to do this thing that my lictors need. And you could be the kind of person that God begs on behalf of. Who wouldn't want that deal? That's incredible.
Interesting. Yeah, we had completely opposite reads of that. It makes me wonder about how, like people who write propaganda are thinking of their audience and are thinking of how they want their audience to interpret it. We could be described as a very similar type of audience.
You and me?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the fact that we read that, what was effectively propaganda, I think we can agree on that.
Totally.
Completely oppositely is really interesting to me from a, like, do propaganda writers know that that is also possible in their writing, and how are they accommodating for that? The larger impression that that gives onto the population in terms of hierarchy is really consequential.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who is sending this missive? What is their individual agenda? Is this, like, God, like, wondering if any of the lictors have any control in propaganda, given the way the houses have a relationship to this, like the third has a relationship to propaganda.
Yeah, this, it really raises the question for me, did John actually personally write this or not?
Yes, that is a really interesting question that I never thought of, because, like, who the fuck would write it if not him?
Who does he trust to be his propaganda minister?
And honestly, if I were God, it would be Augustine.
It would be Augustine.
Yeah, and not because
I agree.
Not because I 100% trust Augustine to do and be trustworthy, but because Augustine's self-interest is very strong.
Also, because his third house lictor is gone, he doesn't have the emperor's mouth.
Which house is Augustine from?
Five. Enjoys the finer things. Valency and... Cyrus. Sorry, I only remember the hot calf.
Cyrus. See, and I don't, like, know any of the extended dramatis personae of the lictors.
Valency and Cyrus used to paint naked pictures of each other.
Gay! Which is, like, weird between necromancer and calf, right?
It is weird.
Okay.
They grew up in the sort of newly formed third house. And they are really into figure painting.
Okay.
And have produced a ton of paintings of themselves and each other nude.
I love figure painting.
And they have decorated the whole of the Mithraeum and also give them out routinely as birthday presents. Ianthe finds this delightful, and Harrow finds it horrifying.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ianthe would. This chapter, like, we've talked a lot about the ways in which Gideon is not actually as likable as we initially left her to be. We're like, actually, Gideon kind of sucks sometimes. This chapter almost pulls a bit of a redemption card, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, she is not distracted by a hot girl walking by. She is actually genuinely very concerned about the safety of the teens and... very aware, not just of their short-term, but their long-term safety, mm-hmm. and makes very courageous choices to try to save them, although it is unsuccessful.
Yeah, and I think so much of all of our characters' arcs are full of heartache, and I think this is one of those interesting moments where, like, we see Gideon at her better side. We see Gideon at the, you know, the kind of heroic that maybe she does fantasize truly being in her military fantasies. Maybe this is actually someone that she wants to be, and immediately is punished for it.
I think also a level on which I really identified with Gideon in this chapter was she experienced a childhood in which she really badly needed an adult to protect her and didn't have one. And she finds Jean-Marie, who she really vibes with, And she tries to be there for Jean-Marie in the way that no one was there for her.
Yeah.
And she isn't able to save Jean-Marie. And I think that that makes the death all the worse for her, because she is seeing Jean-Marie as an extension of herself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that perhaps is a great way of explaining why we don't really see this part of Gideon in the later books. This part of her emerges from time to time, even in Nona, but it's this kind of like really heartbreaking part where her vision of herself as someone who is empowered comes before this, in terms of what she thinks it can actually like do to save her. This kind of like, you know, healing, rescuing, protecting thing is not what she reaches for by default. But it is within her, but it feels like so often every time this part of her is front and centered, it is, she suffers. Which, like, in the reality of what this is trying to portray, like, if you are in a position to either benefit from power or, you know, be a victim of it, like, you're going to try and push back, you will be punished for it. Even in the structure of the fact that, like, Gideon is trying to do better compared to her day-to-day normal. She's like, I'm going to stop thinking of these kids in shitty language. This is clearly an awful situation. They're going through an awful time and they need someone to look out for them. And I'm willing to be that person, and I'm going to be that person, and I'm doing it, and I'm taking us somewhere that I know is like no notes, sweetie, no notes, Gideon. Perfect. And because of the larger system, that's larger things that are operating in.
Well, and I think that tells us how dehumanization gets reproduced.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. In a situation where they're gonna get fucked anyway, it's better not to care. In a situation where these kids were always gonna die, it's so much easier to be Harrow and just be like, yeah, kids die.
It's sad that this part of Gideon that reminds us of both like the cost and the value of that kind of humanization and connection. I think it's this thing that reminds us that like it is what keeps us human, that is being receptive and open to that connection and the pain that comes through it. It is the thing that keeps Gideon as Kiriona still someone that we want to love.
Yeah, there is such a powerful connection between the capacity for grief and the capacity for empathy and staying alive to the value that is in others is so grounded in vulnerability to this kind of heartbreak.
Yeah. There's, you know, kinds of heartbreak that has been so established in Gideon's life that there's no question here, but this is like new emergent elements of heartbreak. You know, there's the fundamental heartbreak of like the dehumanization that she's experienced since infancy and the way that she's been treated in that. But now she's in a context where she's like, I can have agency here. I can choose who I am and where it's going to be. And you know, not feel powerless to the circumstances. And there's like one of the things that I early on articulated this book is it's just like no one's really allowed to be happy and okay in these books.
Yeah.
This isn't my best take, but like, yeah. Like it just like living during these kinds of conditions sucks and inherently makes your soul hurt on a regular basis and normalizes a certain type of soul hurt just in your day-to-day existence from early childhood.
I think my country took over Venezuela.
Yeah, it did. It certainly kidnapped the leader of that country and is so like it hurts to exist under these kinds of things, and they're happening in the real world, and like there's something wonderful about a story that is saying like this is all going to hurt the whole way through, and we're still going to love the shit out of these characters.
Yeah. I think also the limitations on vision and imagination are so critical to shaping the tragedy of this chapter, because as we sort of learn through Gideon's later conversation about this with Harrow, they both had sort of different pictures of the situation. And so they're working on the knowledge that they have. Obviously, nobody knows that Kithorea is the murderer as they're making this plan. So they don't know that they need to guard information from her. But, and, you know, as you and I discussed, you know, Kithorea's imagination is limited by how she understands the situation. But if Gideon had, in fact, brought Jean-Marie to Kithareya's sick room, she wouldn't have gotten murdered because Kithareya would not have been able to murder her in front of everyone without outing herself. And so Gideon's belief that she has to take care of everything herself, that she is the only source of security that she can rely on, is sort of the last nail in the coffin.
Which is just a really, really beautiful and simple thing in terms of like expressing the how these things go. Like when you think that you are alone and when you think that the other people can't be trusted because they aren't sympathetic to your need for safety. And when we're not even willing to take the risk on being wrong about that. Like maybe you're believing it and you're like, okay, but I might be wrong. Like this is the worst outcome, you know, like Gideon could have also had the worst outcome, but had tried trusting people. The worst outcome is that she didn't try and that she is alone in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck it. Maybe Kithareya would have murdered Jean-Marie in front of all of them. Who knows? Maybe Kithareya would have tried to murder all of them at once. Having tried to trust each other is still better. And it's hard.
And Gideon has good reasons not to trust the people that she has.
There is a real inertia of unpredictability and betrayal happening between the group right now. And while they do have solid evidence and previous experience with Plamides and Camilla to be like, okay, if we're going to have to trust someone, these guys are pretty solid. It's not a situation where you really feel like you can rely on anything.
I sort of dig into the planning moment that leads to this outcome in the field analysis. And I have to warn you, if you read it, you're going to like Pal less.
I think one of the most unexpected experiences of doing this podcast so far is how much I like everyone less.
Yeah.
Like, I still love Nona. Nona is my baby. I love that baby. But we haven't technically got there, and maybe I'll also like Nona less when we go into Nona. I'm not surprised, because his existence, his relevance, the role that he is, would not be shaped the way it is, does not look like the way it is without the Empire structure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, him and Camilla, like, Paul is fucking Indiana Jones, right? Like, so there's a way of relating to the larger world that Plamides embodies.
Mm-hmm.
as a fucking academic dweebio, which, like, I fucking get. I was raised by two, like, earth scientists, but who benefited from petroleum extraction. Mm-hmm. So there's this, like, discord between committing to learning about the natural world and doing so only in a framing that is exploitive. So you can be a deeply curious person. You can be a deeply empathetic person. But if your entire framework for applying that is out of that particular, like, I am master over the world framing, that is what Plamides is. So, like, it resonates to, like, a childhood version of me. But, like, the more I look at exactly why he can exist the way he does, why he even talks about things the way that he does. Like, he has it, like, when I think of him talking about old objects, I hear this desire to be intimate and familiar with the story of the object, but as a data point,
mm-hmm.
not as a recognition of something that is and was and is meaningful and is part of his own story of being. Like, it's actually, and that difference is really meaningful to me now in a way that I don't think was, like, 10 years ago in my life.
Yeah.
So I can, if that's kind of, you know, some of the L aspects of Palamides that shine through in a particularly, like, hey, I'm part of this system that already has created me framing, then I'm like, yeah, I could see that coming.
It's who matters to him as an actual person and how small that circle is and how that circle is defined. Because Isaac was never in it for a second. Jean-Marie was never in it for a second. He kind of pretends that Gideon is in it to be polite.
Right.
And Dulcinea isn't in it either.
Yeah, he extends it to Gideon because of Camilla.
And he extends it to Camilla because she's smart, as if she was a necromancer.
Yeah, because he is generally of a gentler kind of temperament, the kinds of power dynamics that he enforces through the way that he generally leads the room in conversation. Like, and I think this is, again, reasons why I find him a very relatable character. Like, I think out of all the characters, for me, Plamid, like, Gideon is obviously, like, a very obvious, like, ah, oh, Claire loves swords. Claire loves Gideon. And I'm like, okay, yeah, but it, as, like, a person, I'm a lot more like Palamides.
I feel like friendly men are allowed to be a lot worse than sort of unpalatable women.
Yes.
And when you get down to it, the distance between Palamides and, like, Iontha is maybe, like, not as far as you would want it to be.
Yeah. And it's interesting because looking at, like, my own behavior in the past, the things that, like, I've gotten away with in terms of brashness or innuendo, there are different archetypes that are allowed allowances. And I have often, when kind of looking and kind of criticizing those exceptions and the hierarchies that are kind of created by those, like, patterns of exceptions, have often kind of reconciled it as, like, okay, this often emerges out of a kind of social capital reconciliation mechanism where the people affected by, okay, for in my example, let's say I was criticized once by a superior that, like, if I was a man, some of the things that I said would have been considered very inappropriate. And I'm like, actually, dude, you're fucking right. I spoke in ways as a leader that were vulgar and possibly could make people feel uncomfortable. And I always thought, oh, because I don't actually have the power to do violence with this language means that it's fine if I do it. And I'm just being playful and emulating someone else's behavior in a way that I think is performance, which is somehow some part of what I do with leadership. But turns out that becomes one of those things where you can't game systems of harm.
Yeah. And in fact, everybody who enacts that harm has first had a pedagogical experience of having harm done to them and has a way of accessing a self-image of powerlessness. When I was being harmed by my fencing coach, the way that people defended him was he's not used to thinking about himself as dangerous because he was bullied as a kid. He thinks of himself as the victim of harm, not the perpetrator of harm. And I was like, what am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah. And like, I can look at the performance that I did within my role, you know, in terms of, like, the persona that was part of that leadership, like, only as harmless within the framework of someone has used these things of behavior to make me feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I must not have any agency. Mm-hmm. While, like, in that situation, now I'm creating normals within the work environment, right?
Yeah.
Which, like,
now you're in leadership. Now you're in power.
And now what I deem important and worthy of changing in terms of those normals that all of us have a cultural reference to is actually the hard part.
And I think to, like, draw this back to Locked Tomb very explicitly, this really connects with how Harrow's sense of powerlessness and desperation creates justification for her to vent off a little steam with Gideon. And I think also how Kithiraea's normal framework is thinking of herself as being so much less powerful than John. And she doesn't think about how much more powerful she is than every other human that exists.
And it's interesting to imagine her being in that headspace, arriving here on the first, and reconciling with the difference between what she expected and what she found. Like, imagining Kithiraea think of herself in some ways as, like, helpless and powerless is really interesting. Because, like, yes, there are moments and positions and spaces in her life where that's very, very real. And this is abso-fucking-lutely the physical place where that's true, right? Like her sense of who she is being taken away from her fundamentally happened here. Mm-hmm. This is a very personal battleground. And so the idea that, you know, regardless of what her relationship with Blood of Eden is like coming into this mission, she hasn't been here in a while, and it wasn't a good time the last time she was here.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, yes, she's one of the most powerful beings in the universe, but here is where she lost her power. Here is where she no longer got to really decide who she was. And everything bad that's happened as a consequence comes back to here. This is not where she feels empowered.
Yeah. I wonder how much of her rage and the sort of like satisfaction almost that she takes in hurting the literal postulants is rage at herself for following this path without understanding what it would really mean.
I think, like, when I first, you know, read this book and had the reveal and was like, oh, it's like this, I don't think I could have told you with these words then, but it was 100% that. It was regret. Like, so much of her motivation to me is about regret and self-blame. Where she's like, I could put myself in her shoes and imagine their time at Kanan House pre-ascension. Mm-hmm. And her thinking of all the moments where she could have said something.
Mm-hmm.
Where she had a gut response of, like, seeing the harm and the death that was coming out of their research. Like, there is a part of her that is still deeply sympathetic. Like, even in her hesitation of, like, I didn't expect them to be so young. Like, she's not, like, yes, she's probably killed children before, but, like, she still doesn't feel okay about it. There is a hesitation in her, and whatever numbness has occurred, it hasn't numbed everything.
I mean, the idea of pointless death is such a core theme,
mm-hmm.
especially with the idea that, like, Lictorhood could be perfect, and the idea that, like, all of these extractive necromantic deaths, you know, the whole concept here, killing entire planets, like, there's this sense of wasted life as such a core theme for her and for the series as a whole. And that feels so hard to juxtapose with, you know, with this pair of deaths.
Yeah. And, you know, almost explicitly kind of setting up a bit of that in the previous chapter where Gideon's like, fuck, couldn't imagine what it would felt like to go through a Volscian chamber and not get a key, where it's like, it sets up suffering as a tradable resource that you mm-hmm. can feel like shortchanged on.
Yeah.
You know, like Gideon's imagining her own life in that framing.
And I think this is the second time that we see a really, really deep recalculation of possibility on Gideon's end. And the first one was after she was caught on the shuttle attempt. And, you know, it was the first time that she had ever gotten close enough to escaping to really hope and feel like it was possible. And she has scaled down possibility to such a small level that in this case was just, you know, I hope that we make it through the next few hours. I hope we make it from this moment into the next moment. And she's learning, no, even that is too much to hope for. And coming out with this sense that hope is just a trap, that there's nothing to be gained from imagination, from hope, from belief in the future.
Yeah.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaylee and edited by Han Kaylee. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's nunpod.com. And remember, there's stuff in the episode notes. Thanks for listening.